Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 7, 2006. Today's session is entitled An Always Audacious Internationalism. Presenter is Michael Pellet and the number is POM 2006-3. Let's listen in.
You want to start burning the CD, Quentin will go for it. And this is our third session looking at Matthew chapter 28, verses 16 to 20. The end of Matthew, where commonly called the Great Commission, where Matthew pulls all the themes from his gospel together, I think. And it's also the last verse of Matthew here is the theme for the summer. I am with you always. So in this week, I'm trying to work through some of those themes that are there at the end of Matthew. And yesterday, we looked at authority and what Matthew means by authority. And from a few folks, there was a request to say a few more things about authority, because for us nowadays, authority is such a problematic kind of thing, because we think of what it is, and some even wanted to go back to the roots of it. So authority is a Latin word. And it comes from, as it comes into English, right, authority from author and itty from itty. Right?
Small.
And author, right, authority would be auctor itas. So that's how it goes. This is from the Latin word augere, from which we also get, Tom, you'll like this one, our word agri, like in agriculture. And literally, it means to make, to grow. Right? So that, I mean, when you think about that, that's what an author is. It makes grow a book or a poem. Or, you know, let's say even there are other things a painter can make grow a painting. And so from there, from authority to make, to grow, you get that notion of an originator or a source. The itty or the itas in English is the way in which we express a state or a condition. So that authority is simply the condition in which one makes or causes something to grow. Larry.
Kind of related to that in our discussion yesterday about who has authority, the word rabbi comes from Hebrew root either rabab or rabah, to increase, which I think is very close to this.
Yes. Precisely. And we'll talk today, when we get to the word disciple, how Matthew parallels that, but then also wants to make a, you know, kind of go off in a very different direction so that disciples are not rabbis. And we'll see how that happens. But this notion about to make, to grow. So if you were with Tom's eye-opener today, he was looking at John 15, the I am the vine, you are the branches, parable by Jesus. In one respect, that's a parable about authority, because the vine or the vine dresser is the authority that makes to grow, causes to grow the branches and that which bears fruit. So that in one sense you can say John 15, the vine and branches is John's parable of how one understands the authority of Jesus.
Yes. I came in late, but did you talk about how that might compare or contrast with the Greek? I mean, you're talking about the Latin of authority, but what about ecclesia?
Right, the exousia.
But is that the same for the Greek kind of?
Well, see, there again, when we talked about in Greek, it would be, I'll just put it into English letter, but exousia, ousia is being, and ex would mean out of or from being, so that again, the very literal sense of that would be coming out of, right, to cause to be, or out of being. And so it has that sense too of causing to grow or increase, would be its most literal understanding.
It's very interesting, especially in the verse saying, if the comparison is saying that he's not teaching as the scribes, and if the scribes were viewed as sort of more holders of power, or even I don't know, be more in the sense of hierarchical power, I wonder,
right.
Does that
right.
have any?
Yeah, well, that's part of the stuff that we talked about yesterday and why people want to, talk about it a little more yet, is that, again, for Matthew, or this sense of authority, like I said, synonyms for authority would be notions of power or freedom. But power here, again, if we stick with the Greek, is dynamis, dynamics, potential, potency, right? It's not a notion of force. So that when we talk about someone having authority, they have power or freedom. Unfortunately, when we think about hierarchy and all of that stuff, we think about authority in terms of some notion of force. There's usually violence attached to it and some kind of coercion. So that the notion of, and this is what happened with the Latins as well, right? Once the Romans got a hold of this notion of authority and kind of Roman law and all of that, you know, this is kind of where we start going downhill a long time ago. The best way I can think of summarizing that is I think what most of us understand about an authority is that an authority is someone or a group which enforces obedience. Right? And again, in Matthew's gospel, Matthew is all for obedience. Right? Doing the will of God, obeying God's will, obeying, following Jesus and Jesus' teachings. And again, the root for obedience literally means listen to or listen toward. Right? And so that's key. What is not there in Matthew's gospel, but the baggage we carry with us because of the cultural... is that notion of enforcing. So that we always think, that the enforcing always means you have to carry the big stick as well, so that we can be nice and we can be and smile, but to say, and of course, if you don't listen to me, I'm going to have to hit you. Right? That's our sense of authority, and therefore there's always threat with it. And the sense of Jesus' authority is not threat. So again, yesterday we looked at the verses in the other places in Matthew's gospel where Matthew uses the word authority, talks about authority. The very end of the Sermon on the Mount, again, that Jesus teaches with an authority not like the scribes and the others. Again, here, just to summarize that it's Jesus' very self that is the authority. It's self-authenticating. Right? Again, the first person singular pronouns there, right? I say to you, right? These kinds of things. We looked at the notion of the healing of the centurion's servant. And at first, again, everybody looked at that, you know, notion of the centurion saying, you know, when I say go, people go and do this. And we said, oh, yeah, we really got into the enforce obedience mode. And I said, no, I got to think about that differently. And to say, again, fancy rhetorical term, the perlocutionary sense of authority, where saying it is doing it. Genesis 1 is a good example, right? Let there be and there was. The very power of the word to make something so. That's having authority. We skipped these two, and that's what people wanted us to look at a little bit. And the last one was in Matthew chapter 21, the distinction between, again, the authority of Jesus over against that of the religious leaders. And again, noting that authority is not in terms of popular opinion, popularity, pleasing the polls, or legitimizing yourself in that way. The one last one that I want to look at here is this one. This is the story of the healing of the paralytic. And it's in Matthew chapter 9. Verse 6 has the passage with authority in it. So if someone would read Matthew chapter 9, verse 6, please.
But so that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, he then said to the paralytic, stand up, take your bed, and go to your home.
Okay. What's the issue there about authority? What's the question of authority that's raised in that passage?
Attachment to a title. Recognizable.
Okay, so there's a title there, Son of Man. What else?
Well, authority to forgive sins.
Right. I mean, in that sense, no one really at that point seemed to question, if you will, Jesus' authority to heal, but the authority to forgive was truly questioned. And there's another little phrase in there to think, to the question, does he have authority to do this on earth? Yes,
please. Since the Son of Man is both a title in the Old Testament and the intertestamental period, is that new? In terms of what is old, Son of Man, is it new to say on earth compared to the intertestamental writings and the Old Testament?
Yeah, well, the Old Testament, intertestamental, the Son of Man is that kind of divine agent, apocalyptic figure who will come from heaven to earth, basically simply to judge, not necessarily to forgive. So
right.
The twist is to forgive and to forgive on earth. Right.
So on
in
earth
other
is,
words, among humans. Here.
It's a new teaching.
So it's a in that sense, it's a new twist. Yeah. And now the question to say here, why would forgive, how does forgiveness link up with authority? Why would you need to have authority? Or why is it that when you forgive, you are acting authoritatively? And we'll even take this literally. You're causing something to grow.
Only God. Some. I don't know if it's Matthew or where I remember. Only God has that ability.
Right. That would be the criticism that the scribes and others are bringing against Jesus. And Jesus, you can't do that. You don't have that authority. Only God has that authority. But now Jesus claims that authority, and again, he will also give that to his followers to say, we too have that authority to forgive. Why is forgiving linked with authority?
In some ways, that's the only way you can get on with things.
Yeah. That again, right? Forgiving is a tremendously powerful thing. That it is the way of new creation, right? And that in that sense, when you forgive, indeed you are doing only what God supposedly can be doing, and that is creating anew. Now, why is that, right? I mean, that's what I think so important here about this, and why, you know, so often in the church, oh yeah, forgiveness, blah, 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 I've been there, done all that kind of stuff. But right, in that sense, you can never talk about forgiveness enough, because it's related to authority, and again, to a notion of action. If we think about action just a little bit, two key things about action with regard to any one of our actions. It's unpredictable in terms of its ongoing consequences, and it's irreversible. Think about any action. I mean, have you ever done something and the consequences of it weren't at all what you thought were going to happen? But too late. Can't take it back now. Right? Think about something, you know, saying something you shouldn't have said, or saying something and it was taken in the wrong way. What are you going to do, right? It's irreversible. It's out there. The consequences are there. You can't take it back. You are to really up the ante, which is what Paul would do, which is what Matthew would do. Now, you are enslaved to that action, right? You're stuck with those consequences. You can't get out. But the person can come along and to say, I forgive. And one of the words, apiemi, forgive, literally means release. In other words, I release you. I liberate you from those unpredictable, irreversible consequences in which you are enslaved. And that means what? We can start over. We can begin again. Hebrew way of putting it, when God forgives, says, I will remember your sins no more. That is, it's as if it didn't happen. And so forgiving, that release, right, that authority has with it that tremendous sense of freedom, because what you do when you forgive, what God does when God forgives, is bestow freedom upon you so that you can begin again. Right? Most radically put, you're a new creation. Right? What authority? Authority. What authority I have if I say, I forgive you. And what authority you have when you forgive me. And again, as we recognize in terms of at least our liturgy in the Lutheran Book of Worship, in terms of confession and absolution, right? The pastor declares that forgiveness to all of us, again, not by his or her authority, but again, by the authority of Christ,
right?
That authority which is given to us, we declare forgiveness, which makes, again, all of us capable of beginning again, right? Causing us to grow. Link it back to John, right? To be fruitful. What a tremendous gift. Yes?
I like when you said about being enslaved after an action happens, and I wonder if we could also tie that to the act of forgiveness, you know, between one another, using the strength and power of the cross. I mean, from a human perspective, I don't see forgiveness as a one-time thing, you know, that it's a process. And what is the power of the word to say you're entering into a process of forgiveness with someone? It doesn't mean that you're entering into a process of bargaining or a process of saying that there isn't still going to be anger and there still isn't going to be things to work out. But by entering into that beginning word of forgiveness, it makes me think of the word promise in a way that a promise, when you make a promise to someone, it also kind of enslaves you. And I think in the best way, to say you're actually like living outside yourself. And I wonder if we can look at forgiveness similarly. I mean, we're talking about forgiveness. I mean, I think one of the mistakes we make with forgiveness is to think of it as a one-time thing.
Right.
Even biblically. I mean, I think of God's constant relationship with humankind, and there are one-time statements, but there's always a process of dialogue and always a process of continuing action. So how do we relate that to our sort of human way of forgiveness and process?
Anybody else want to chime in on that?
Well, I'm sorry, I've got a different topic than that one. Maybe somebody
else. That's
fine. All right, well, anyone want to address this one?
Well, you can ask for forgiveness, but it doesn't do anything for the action.
Say a little more. It doesn't do anything.
Well, if I sin, say I start a war, and then I think, oh, that's wrong, and I ask forgiveness, the war still goes on. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, yeah. But the thing is, in terms of who you are, right? The forgiveness in all of that allows you to begin again.
I know, but the sin that I did against that person, I want that person to become whole as they were before I did that sin.
Right.
But they don't.
No, that can't happen. I mean, that's the sense there. It is irreversible with regard to those consequences. And that's why the person who forgives, if you will, is going to say, I will not hold you to all of this so that you are enslaved by that. That's why, in that sense, again, right, forgiveness is a gift. It is something that is bestowed upon you. It's not something you yourself can do to change anything.
So there's no way to change the sin?
No. No, I mean, think about my small example, right? You say something you wish you wouldn't have said. There's nothing you can do to take that back.
And often those sins are life-changing to that person or that thing that you've sinned against, but then that person takes up the burden of dealing with it and goes through their whole, I mean, without being specific, whether it's a rape or a physical abuse or, I mean, that changes the ante, changes everything, but you can still be free of that. I mean,
yes, so that, I mean, there, I think for Daniel's question, the way I would answer that is, again, Right? What we're saying here in terms of forgiveness is we're not saying, if you will, let's say a sin. We're not saying, oh, well, that sin was okay, that's all right, forget it. I mean, you know, sure. I mean, you know, wars, you know, this war's not bad. No, this war was bad. This rape was bad. And, you know, we're not going to make that go away and say, oh, well, evil isn't evil. No, but you do forgive.
Yeah.
And sometimes you find that the sinner, the person that has done the sin, just becomes this whole new incredible person that does. There is some good sometimes.
Sometimes, but certainly not with those rapists that just go on with children for time after time. Of course, I guess they don't feel they're sinning. I don't know.
Well, no, that, I mean, whether they're sinning or feel they're sinning or not, that, you know, if you will, that's not what we're talking about here when we talk about the sense of forgiveness, right? The forgiving is, again, providing one with the opportunities to start anew. They may not, right? I mean, it's also in Matthew's gospel where Peter asked Jesus, well, you know, if my brother sins against me and I forgive him, and he, you know, how many times do I have to forgive? And, you know, Jesus says 7 times 7 or 70 times. In other words, that notion of forgiveness and what's at work there, you know, may or may not be what will change that person. You know, you may forgive the person, but you would also want to make sure the person spends the next 30 years in jail. That could be, right? That could be a very real possibility.
I think in terms of authority, I think you have to have a certain amount of authority to accept forgiveness. That is, if you don't have a certain amount of self-worth, self-value, in some ways it's very difficult to accept forgiveness.
Okay.
I think forgiveness also affects the forgiver as much as the one receiving forgiveness.
Certainly.
So that action is, is as, and this goes a little bit back to, I think, what you were saying, Daniel, about being enslaved to forgiveness. Both the person who is forgiven and the person who is the forgiver, They are both sort of enslaved, again, in that best possible sense, to the process of forgiveness. Mm-hmm.
I think another part that's so difficult is it's very hard to forgive.
Yes.
I mean, it's almost impossible. So that's another whole, how do you learn how to forgive? I mean, when it is such a terrible thing.
I mean, I think finally that's why theologically, we would really say forgiveness is an attribute of God. Because finally, only God truly can forgive. In that sense of, it seems a sense of forgiving calls on more than we as humans ever have the resources or capacity to do.
I know that from personal experience with my wife. I mean, just a few months ago, I'm involved in a very difficult argument where I physically just separated myself from her in a room. And that argument was so real, and it's almost like you could feel the division between us. And when one of us then made the overture to pray, I mean, that was the space that was opened up in that solidifying, you know, argument that allowed us to forgive one another. And I'll never forget it. And I mean, you can psychologize it away all you want, but I know that I needed that we needed to depend on the power of God's forgiveness for us to make that space. And so that was very powerful.
Go ahead, Tom, and then we can go.
Yeah, I think forgive is another word that we kind of misuse, like the word love. I mean, lots of times we say, I forgive you, but what I'm really saying is, okay, I'm trying to get past this. I'm hurt. I still have the pain in me, but I'm going to try to get past it and try to release you of this, try to have this release. But it's not happening, but I'm saying the words, so I'm in that process. But the actual forgiveness, this total release, is maybe yet to come.
Well, I think it's significant that Jesus links himself to this title, or Matthew does, I guess, whoever. And that the Son of Man becomes something other than one bringing wrath. That's really important to me.
Right.
And that the authority, I guess I believe, I don't know if you agree with this or not, but I believe that a lot of those people Jesus were talking to had a very strong sense of the theory of atonement, and that life force is required to give life. Blood is required to give life to others. Atonement of sacrifice. For the Son of Man to come and give life is totally opposed and opposite to a lot of the intertestamental images of the Son of Man coming just to bring death and destruction to the wicked and the unrighteous. And so, it's for me, it's a very radical new teaching. And then for Jesus to tell his disciples that they have the same power and authority is just incredible. And so, for me, forgiveness is, at least in its purest sense, is giving life where sin brings death. I guess I believe that somehow, the ultimate act of that atonement is being raised from the dead. I'm not going to be very conscious of that, but God's still going to make it irreversible action. Mm-hmm. I like that, irreversible and unpredictable.
I was just wondering to what extent you could talk about forgiveness as a form of enslavement, in that, I mean, I was thinking of several things while people were talking. One is you think of those many, many hymn lines that say things like, make me a captive and then I shall be free. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about what Dan was saying, that ultimately, in a relationship, no one's clever enough, smart enough, wears enough right perfume, or dances well enough, or has a nice manners enough or is witty enough to entertain another person. And so there's either the cement that the enslavement that forgiveness brings, or would that be inappropriate? I think to the famous no man is a hero to his valet. I think there is a sense of being captured in forgiveness. Mm-hmm. For me.
But also a sense of freedom, right? I'm thinking, I'm trying to remember what's Luther's line about the freedom of a Christian is that you are free lord of all, subject to no one, and then you're also, on the other hand,
slave
to all, subject to everyone. So that's in Christ, you're free to serve and to be a slave and to tie yourself through a promise. It's not your own strength, it's given to you.
I seem to always put the pastors on the cutting edge here. So when you are doing marriage counseling, do you talk about forgiveness?
You betcha.
I hope so.
I'll have just answer for myself.
It's
right, yes.
A marriage ceremony, actually.
Yeah, but people must not be getting it.
Human beings, right?
Well, you know.
No, I don't know.
That's kind of, to me, just how far do I want to go with this? There's kind of something to to me, in terms of ministry, I don't know, Sarah, you can, Marita, and others here can check. I mean, it seems at times some of the most futile things you do is the pre-marriage counseling and the marriage service, because after all, especially for young people, I mean, they're in love. Right. So, you know, it doesn't make any difference what you talk about, because after all, they're in love. Besides, they've got the hall rented and the band and everything, and
so
the invitations
don't
are out, so you know, what could you do?
It doesn't
even
matter
if they
you
should,
don't.
You know.
If you say don't, because they will anyway.
They might go ahead and do it anyway.
They might.
She has to be
never
able to say don't.
Stop.
You can.
Yeah.
You have
yes.
I mean,
yes. Yes, I have.
Good.
There are some, you know, some people just want to go on to that.
And I shouldn't just say marriage. I should say relationships, because so much of the sinning is against a friend or a partner or a neighbor. But
there, I mean, you know, quite, let's say, you know, when you know the marriage is in trouble and people come in and talk to it, then they are much more open to listen to notions of forgiveness. But, you know,
But I don't think marriage counselors even go there.
It all depends. I know some who do. But, you know, I mean, yeah, we talk about forgiveness, and I also talk about it in the context. I spend a whole session on how to fight fair. Because you are going to fight. So the issue is, do you fight fairly?
Well, I have a feeling I got no problem with the old things being saying in terms of forgiveness, which is started out on the basis of authority.
That's right.
And here Jesus is talking to these scribes, and he's making a very strong statement of his authority in this case, because primarily in Jewish culture they blame various things on the sins of the father, or the having sinned themselves, whatever else. These problems of being paralytic, whatnot, quite often were viewed as a result of sin. And what they're saying here is, by what authority are you forgiving sin? Not just merely saying, get up and walk. And so, to me, that's a very powerful statement. He says, what's easier to say, your sins are forgiven, or stand up and walk? He could say, stand up and walk, and be looked at as a magician if something happened. But he's saying something very strong in this sense, in terms of forgiving sins.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely, yeah. And that's, again, why that's where the real authority is in that passage, the authority to forgive, yeah.
He's also calling into question the whole need for the temple and the priests, because after you give your offering, which didn't always have to involve a sacrifice. For example, if you're poor, it could be just a simple grain offering or something. But weren't you supposed to show yourself to the priest?
Mm-hmm.
And so if Jesus he's in that sense, he's a threat to the establishment.
Yes, that's my and this will be my last word on authority. In Matthew's gospel, the claim here, to put it as succinctly as possible, the authority that Jesus claims for himself with regard to the Jewish tradition, then, is Jesus is saying, by the authority that has been given to me by God, right? Matthew's claim, our claim now, is that Jesus is Torah, the instruction, the word and revelation of God, and Jesus is temple, because temple is understood as the focal point of God's presence, God's glory. So that the Torah was God's word, was God's instruction, or I'll just use this,
God's word, and the temple is the place of God's presence. And in the end here, right, Jesus is saying, teach all that I have commanded you. I'm the word, I'm the Torah, and I am with you always. I'm the temple. So in other words, again, right, you don't need a temple because you've always got the temple with you. You always have God's presence with you. Jesus is Torah and temple. One place here yet that I'd like. Matthew chapter 23, verses 8 to 12. Yes, and again, someone would read that.
But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher, and you are all students. And call no one your father on earth, for you have one father, the one in heaven. Nor are you to be called instructors, for you have one instructor, the Messiah. The greatest among you will be your servant, and all who exalt themselves will be humbled. And all who humble themselves will be exalted.
There you go. So we have one Father, one teacher. Note how that messes up the whole world. Because of the whole notion of Father is going to bring into account, right, all of our biological, social, political, economic ways of doing things, right? I mean, all those who are, you know, the family is the foundation of society and all other kinds of things, all other kinds of authorities spring out of that notion of family. Well, okay, if it is only God who is Father, and again in that context, you know, the paterfamilias, the head of the household, well, all of a sudden then Jesus has defined for us a whole new social, political, and economic way of relating to one another. It's not the usual way. With a total redefinition and revamping of society, political, community, economics, oikonomos. And we also have one teacher. So there's no more quite this sense of rabbis in the way the rabbis were doing, or teachers and instructor. We have only one teacher, right? The sent one, the anointed one, the Messiah. Jesus. And who are all of us then? That gets us, finally we might get to what we're going to talk today, about today, right? Disciples. And so again, right, Matthew certainly has a notion of church, but it's no hierarchical notion of church. You don't have, if you will, a magisterium, because there is only one magister, one master, one teacher. That's Jesus. The rest of us, just disciples. Whether you're a professor of theology or not, you're just a disciple. The Pope, just a disciple. That's the understanding that Matthew is putting forward. So it's a, you know, again, thinking about communities and the way in which we relate to one another. Kind of upsets us, or might upset some of us a little bit, because it's not the typical either cultural ways of doing it or even the churchy ways in terms of some of the structures and everything that we have done. But again, note, it's not an antinomian, a lawless or an anti-authority understanding. But it is a true, if you will, gospel-centered way, Christ-centered way of thinking about what authority
authority is. And then once we know that, then we can understand ourselves as disciples.
In that model, then, since I do think tribes, numbers and tribes are important in Matthew, and you end up with 11, are the Gentiles, all those that are not previously belonging to a tribe of God, are they the 12th tribe? The Mormons make quite a big teaching about being the lost tribe. How in Matthew's, in this, especially with reference to these verses, what do you think about, is there only one tribe?
It's a very inclusive. I mean, again, in the passage we're looking at today, it's go disciple all nations. Ponta ethne. And again, nation, ethnos, that is there, from which we get our word ethnic. Again, the Septuagint, that's the Greek translation of the Hebrew word for Gentiles. But when you say all, you can't just say all Gentiles, now all nations opens it up to such a way that it is as inclusive as you can be. It means everyone.
This is about as close as Matthew would get to the Luke and idea of a new age.
Yes, this is the new age for Matthew. I mean, if we want to make that comparison, this is Matthew's way of talking about the new age. Okay, let me say a little bit here about disciples. Making disciples. And again, that's a fine English translation, but it again, in our way of doing things, right, when we talk about making disciples, what's happened with that notion, I think, is that we get out there and we always want to bring that sense of kind of enforcing, converting, coercing along with it. That, you know, it's that simply the verb there would be the kind of thing as a command. Jesus is just simply telling us, go and disciple all nations. It's not the kind of thing that we're talking about conversions or Billy Graham crusades or have a revival meeting or something like that. Disciple is you're in it for the long haul kind of term, right? It's literally, if you mathetes there, literally means there you go. To bring to school. That's not a very sexy term at all, as they would say, is it? Right? Bring, and of course, when you bring someone to school to educate and all, that's for the long haul. Right? That's a sense now, if you will, where you walk and live with someone for who knows how long, right? Here again, the notion, the paradigm for what discipling is all about is Jesus himself. Jesus discipled his disciples. And that wasn't a weekend revival meeting. It was a long haul kind of understanding. The other places where Matthew uses this verb disciple, two very interesting places. Chapter 13, verse 52, and chapter 27, verse 57. We'll look at those two passages a little bit yet today, and then I guess I'll talk about disciple and the others tomorrow as we try and catch up. Let's first of all look at chapter 27, verse 57. And if you find that, if someone would read that for us, please.
When it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who was also a disciple of Jesus.
Yeah, there you go. That's not a very exciting passage, was it? Who was also a disciple of Jesus.
Okay.
They're trying to make good sense of that in English. But that the word who was a disciple, Matthew, in the Greek, it's a verb. If you would give that, try to give that a kind of literal translation, it would be that this was Joseph of Arimathea who had been discipled to Jesus. Isn't that interesting? Right? That Joseph was one who had been discipled to, or sometimes you might want to say by, it all depends, Jesus. All you Greek scholars, aorist passive followed by a dative. But the interesting thing here is, right, they said a disciple of you. What does it mean when you put this into a verb? Who had been discipled? So Sarah goes out to internship and writes the little bio on herself. And she says, you know, hello, I'm Sarah. I am one who had been discipled by Jesus. Or had been discipled to Jesus. What's the difference between saying that and saying, I am a disciple of Jesus? On the one hand, you say, not much difference at all. But on the other hand, right, since we're trying to look at this stuff carefully, I think there's a very significant difference. What do you see as the difference?
Jesus' action.
You got it. You betcha. Right? All of a sudden here, right, what's being emphasized again is Jesus' action. So that again, when you go out and disciple, you know, it's not the kind of thing to say, oh, look at how many I've converted. Look at how many people I've brought to Jesus. Look, you know. No, you got it backwards, don't you? That a disciple is always one who had been discipled to or by Jesus. That discipling itself is already a gift. That's what God's action is all about. Right, so again, you know, and if this is your favorite hymn, sorry, but don't think about Matthew's Great Commission as now after we've studied these passages, we're going to go out of here going, onward Christian soldiers, marching at the war. Because we're not doing that. That's not what disciple is about. It's what we do is we bring to school. We live and walk with others such that Jesus' action happens. And that's long haul stuff. It's not, you know, if you will, in that sense, the one-time mountaintop experience, and then that's it. But it's there for the long haul. And so discipling is a vocation, a calling that is constant. And as disciples, as those who had been discipled or have been discipled to Jesus, we understand what that discipling is about, and so engage that with others. It's not very dramatic. It's day-to-day living with others. Chapter 13, verse 52, please, if someone would read that.
And he said to them, therefore, every scribe who has been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like the master of a household who brings out of his treasure that which is new, what is old. Was that right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Do you all have the NRSV translation there? I think so. That scribe trained for the kingdom of heaven, right? There they use the word trained. It's the same verb, disciple. That again, literally, the scribe who has been discipled for the kingdom of heaven. Which is, again, I think here for Matthew's nuance is a little different than training. You have been discipled, and once having been discipled, you go into your treasury, your thesaurus. Treasury of words is what a thesaurus is for. And you bring out something new and something old. What is that all about in terms of discipling?
Can you put that another way? I'm quite sure I've got you.
What, in terms of that passage, if what Jesus is saying there is that we have been discipled to, right, reach into that treasury that we have that has been given to bring out something new and to bring out something old, what are we doing? What would discipling be?
It's incorporation.
Incorporation?
It's merging. It's knowing what you... It's bringing what you know, that what you don't know, that the teacher gives you.
Right. So I mean, that, yeah, that's right. It's, you know, again, that sense of... Right. We're bringing out the new and the old, what we know and what we don't know. There can be those kinds of things. There's also, in terms of the old, we could say that's a sense of tradition that's always there, but the new is always the understanding that to keep the tradition alive, right, and not make it again just enforcing rules and regulation, but truly a living sense of word and dynamic among us, the new is always, I'll just say that, a sense of application to a new situation. In other words, as we go about discipling, on the one hand, it's the same old thing that Jesus is asking those disciples so many centuries ago to do. On the other hand, this is a new place and time, and it's going to be done differently. It's still discipling, but it's new, different, applied in a new way.
And that's where we sometimes then run into difficulty, because my interpretation might be different than his or hers in terms of making the old fit the new.
Mm-hmm. And that's right? That's always the challenge. How do these two fit together and relate to each other appropriately?
You've heard it said, but I say to you, always anew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sounds like too much work. Sounds like too much work.
It's a lot of work. It's called a lifetime of work. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even for your own life. Mm-hmm. Right? The interesting thing in terms of this passage is that the church fathers in interpreting this passage, if you look at folks like Origen and Augustine and Chrysostom and all those folks whose names may or may not be important, they understand this passage as autobiographical with regard to Matthew. They look at this passage and say, well, Matthew's really talking about himself here. That isn't that what Matthew did? That Matthew indeed was a scribe for Jesus, right? And he looked at that word that Jesus had and knew K-N-E-W, when to bring out something new, the way in which Jesus proclaimed the gospel, like we talked about forgiveness, but also kept that in line with the old. Because again, of all the gospel writers, Matthew, of all four gospel writers, quotes more from the Old Testament than the others. I mean, he's, you know, Matthew loves and reveres the tradition. And yet at the same time, as you've said, we'll say, you have heard it said, the old, but I say to you, the new. And so in that sense, you can say Matthew's gospel is precisely doing what this passage says. It is, again, another way of understanding what discipling is all about, what discipling means.
We're keeping the idea of Torah. We're just changing the way that we understand it. We're keeping the idea of temple. We're just changing the way in which it dwells with the people.
Right.
Yeah.
How would we be able to make sense of the new except through the context of the old? How do we make sense of this Jesus character except by drawing on the tradition they've all been steeped in, Jesus is part of. But it's now you have to, can't just say the same thing. Say, and it says something new. It makes no sense without the old tradition.
Right.
I'm still confused by the past tense. It is past.
Passive. Or the aorist.
Has been discipled.
Yeah, has been discipled.
The line that I like that helps me make sense of that is that Jesus says that I will draw all people to myself. Maybe just put it, he will draw all people to himself. I don't remember. But like on the cross.
Yeah, I will draw people to myself.
Right, something that Jesus is
John's
doing.
Gospel, but go, yeah.
No, but it's a line that helps make sense.
Oh, I
that.
Sure, yeah.
That it's not something that we do. It's something that Jesus is doing, perhaps through us.
Mm-hmm.
We always think that we're the actors. We need to die into that.
Right, and that then that's again the linkage here between disciples and authority, isn't it? Because Jesus is the authority, that which causes to grow. And discipling is just simply one of the way in which Jesus, it's the instrument, if you will, that Jesus uses to cause things to grow. It's not that discipling makes us the agent or the actor. And that's again why the passive is important here in that sense, that, you know, it's not what we do, in the sense of it's my agency, it's my authority. that sense, we bring them to school. We bring them. We teach Jesus. We are out of time. Thank you. Oh my goodness! Wow, we 5 minutes passed. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll pick it up tomorrow.